Well, good morning. It's great to be here with you. And I think the last time I was here was about 5 years ago. So hopefully it's because people thought I did a decent job back then. I don't know. Like, you know, 5 years is a long time, was it? Did I mess up then? Now that I'm making everyone feel a little awkward. I want to share a little bit more about this passage because it's meant so much to my wife and to me, and I share it with you just as, because I think it's just on God's heart. The title of this is Expanding Our Sense of Family, because I think that Jesus really does expand our sense of family. Hopefully we have some positive experiences in our families of origin, and He wants to take those things and multiply them and share that with others for our blessing and for others as well. When I graduated from college in 1994, I got a job at Intel, and I also moved into this Mexican immigrant community. And, you know, one thing that I really had to overcome was some of these challenges of cross-cultural learning. I moved in with some mentors of mine who were having a Spanish-speaking Bible study, and I play guitar, and I wanted to, I was already like playing guitar for this Bible study, and I wanted to understand a little bit more who are these people that I was knowing and meeting, and especially what was the experience of these children. So I moved in, and, you know, I would introduce myself to people in this apartment complex as, you know, I would say, "Hi, I'm Mako," and the children would laugh. And the adults would just kind of look at me and like squint and say, "Like, really?" You know, and I would just be puzzled by this. So I asked my mentors, the Espinosas, "Why do people give me this funny response?" And they said, "Oh, you know why? It's because in Spanish, Mako is really close to moco, which means boogers." And, you know, and here I was thinking, oh, you know, I've gone through all this kind of reconciling with myself and my my name being a Japanese name and not being a more Western name, and I come to terms with that, so now I have to deal with this. I asked them, "Should I go by my full name, Makoto, which means truth, right? I mean, I'd really come to own that and learn that some of the history of this name." And Jose and Jennifer said, "No, I don't think you really want to do that, because in Spanish, if you add ito to anything, it's small. But if you add oto, it's big. So Makoto is like big boogers." I was like, "Oh, I just can't win here." But, you know, that was a little bit of my journey, and it just gives me an example. It was a touching point to understanding, oh, this is a little bit, just a little tiny bit, of what Jesus felt as he entered our world, into coming into a world that is different from his own, right, and the heavens, and what he experienced. So I was getting to know a bunch of families in this apartment complex. And one day, as I was heading out to work, there was a grandmother. She was about 50 years old, and her name is Graciela, and we called her Doña Chiela. She asked me, could I give her a ride to work? And her usual ride had been arrested. So I said, "Well, sure, hop in." You know, she worked at a potpourri making factory about 10 minutes away from my office, so it wasn't too big of a deal. So, you know, we did that, and I figured, like, well, I love this family, and it's a good chance for me to practice Spanish. So I did that. The next morning, there she was again, and she said, "Can you give me another ride? And by the way, can you give me a ride home, like, after work? Because if I take the bus, it would take me about an hour and a half and 2 hours." And she was the main homework help for her grandkids. They lived all together. So, you know, I know Uriel and Claudia and the other kids. So, of course, I want them to have grandma there for help. So I said, "Yes, sure. What time do you usually get off?" And she said, 4:30. I was like, "Oh, interesting. Well, we'll try that." Because at Intel, most people work 60 hours a week, right? And I was a single guy just out of school. And many of you know, when you're in that life stage, the company looks at you like, your life should revolve around this. Right? Like, what else have you got going on? So I, you know, said, hey, I just want everyone to know I've done these things and I will be in early. So I shifted my hours to 7:30 to 4:30 so we could make this work. A few months later, one of my supervisors came to me and said, Maka, we want you to consider this move. It's kind of a promotion. You would have more visibility. The company would have more visibility into you. We were in-house management consultants helping out with the major chip design projects, Pentium 2, Pentium 3 and 4, and so on. So I said, well, I'm honored by that. Can I have some time to ask more questions and think about that? I did. I prayed. I studied scripture. And I came back and I said, no, I can't do that. Because in my mind, you know, this would require 60 hours plus a week. This organization over here was just in such disarray that it wouldn't have worked. And I was committed to bringing this grandmother to and from work because Jesus was expanding my sense of family. Like, they were my family. So I said no. And my supervisors were a bit puzzled, but they said, okay. A few months later, there was another invitation. Consider this other organization. Go work with them. And I said, you know, I'm really grateful. I am looking for other kinds of opportunities, but this just means that I would have to spend too many hours at work, and I just can't do that right now. They said, okay, what is going on with you? Why? And I said, well, it's because I'm taking this Mexican grandmother to and from work, and she has to be at home with her grandkids. And why are you doing that? Well, it's because I live in this community, and I love Jesus, and I think Jesus is caring about these families. And I'm wanting my life to be more about that, and at least include them in my decisions. So it's not that I was doing a bad job, mind you, but I couldn't take these promotions because of how it would impact others that God had made, in some sense, my family. There was a few days after that conversation, which I was actually winding up feeling grateful for, because I had a chance to witness in a really meaningful way to my supervisors about my life of faith. And they really started to take me more seriously. But a few days later, Doniacella and I were driving home, and she, out of the blue, she asks me this question. Said, Marco, would you be the godfather, el padrino, for Uriel, one of her grandsons? And I was just so amazed and so grateful, because in her family and in that culture, what that means is special. If something had happened to the parents or to her as grandma, it's possible that they would have wanted Uriel to be raised by me. And at the very least, if that didn't happen, they just wanted me to be involved with the family. They were really embracing me as part of their family. And I just felt so honored by that. And that is a little bit of a picture of what happens, I think, as Jesus expands our sense of family. And I want to invite you to consider ways in which that could be true. There are probably people and faces and names or situations that come to mind as I share these things and as we reflect on the scripture. And I want you to hold that before the Lord, because maybe that is Him speaking to you about that. The passage that we are going to reflect on is the Luke 14 passage that we read. And I want to give a little bit of the background so that we can appreciate just how radical, how awkward, and how amazing this word is. Jesus is beginning His movement. Roughly speaking, He's about maybe in the middle of His 3-year earthly ministry with His followers, and He is training them to be on mission with Him. He is going to empower them by His Spirit at the end of that 3-year period and send them out into the world to reflect something about His love and His mission for every single person in this world and His desire to transform and heal humanity. And so He winds up being invited by, well, I guess we would call it today a frenemy. There are people in the Jewish community in the first century that were kind of interested in who Jesus was, but also kind of opposed and were trying to control / manage Him so that He didn't get too popular. So one of those groups was the Pharisees, and there you could think of them as, yes, they're a religious party, but they're also an ethnic nationalist group that believed this is what it meant to be truly Jewish, is be real pious, to hold to Jewish blood purity, and also some culturally specific things about, like, this is how we know we're Jewish enough. Jesus had a very different opinion about what it meant to be Jewish, because to Him it meant be a blessing and to reflect God's image to all of humanity. That is what it meant to be Jewish to Jesus. And one of the things that He was doing was eating with people, because eating was a reflection of Eden. That was the origin of God's relationship with humanity. When God made us to eat with Him, He said, except for this one tree, everything you see before you is open to you. I've made it all good, and I want to eat together with you. It is a banquet, and Jesus was giving a small window of insight back into that original garden as He ate with people and as He invited people from far and wide, not being exclusive, being inclusive, inviting everyone to eat with Him, because it was an invitation to rethink Eden. Here is God in the flesh now eating with us and inviting us to the table. That's Jesus' agenda. And so it ran smack up against some of this, the other Jewish kind of factions. And the one who had invited Him had said, hey, Jesus, why don't you eat with us? We want to hear you again. We're respected, you're respected, but we don't think you should be eating with other people. And here in this context, Jesus says, "Do not." He turns to His host and says, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite these people that you just have. Can you imagine how awkward that is? Do you ever go to someone's house or a party or a dinner and turn to your host and say, you know, you're doing it all wrong? Like, publicly, in front of all the other guests. Can you imagine what that must have been like? People really must have felt awkward at that point. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe He said that. But again, for Jesus, eating is not just, hey, let's share a meal. It's not just a slice of life. Because who you ate with reflected who you considered your equals, who you shared your secrets with, who you were inviting into your life to be more than just, hey, let's just get together. So, you know, in our day and age, if you want to grab lunch or coffee with someone, it's almost like, that. Well, that's something you can do with people you're just getting to know. And that's great, but in Jesus' day, eating was not just that. Eating reflected, you're saying we are the same status, we're the same family here, and we share all things. So that's what Jesus was about. And so when He is saying, you know, I don't like the way that you guys eat, because you only invite people like yourselves, that has to ring a bell, right? I mean, even if we didn't know some of the cultural context, that would have to stand out as, that is radical to us. Because I don't know about you, because who do you like to go out to eat with? I like to go out to eat with people who will haggle with me about the check. Right? And so when the check comes, hey, let me get that. Oh, no, let me get that. Oh, no, you take care of it next. No. And then on and on we go until one of us finally picks it up. And then over time, it just kind of averages out, right? Because it's all about reciprocation. And maybe, is that a human nature thing? Is that especially an Asian thing? I don't know. But that just seems intuitive, because can you imagine what it would be like to go out with someone and you say, let me get the check, and they say, okay. And then you do it again. And again. And pretty soon you're wondering, when's this guy ever going to pay? He doesn't even offer. It's ridiculous. Jesus says, yeah, that's the kind of party you want to throw. Really? Why? Why does Jesus do that? Well, let's look at who it is he wants to invite. Invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Is that how it translates here? Yeah. Now, who were these people back then? How do we read that today? In Israel, in the first century, this group of people, obviously they are vulnerable. Maybe they were born into some unfortunate circumstance or with some birth defect. So they're vulnerable, but they're also pushed to the margins socially, because some in that day believed that if you were born poor or born with a birth defect, you were cursed by God. There was something that you or your parents did in terms of sin, so such that you deserved that condition. That did not actually come from the Old Testament, but nevertheless, people thought that. And that's kind of easy to do, right? I mean, because even today, we do carry some of that attitude. We say, we look at poor children and we say, well, somehow they're not deserving of help. Look, I mean, if you were there yesterday afternoon when we talked about Leviticus 25 and some of the laws of the Old Testament and how God would say, you know, I press this reset button every 7 or 50 years, depending on what's going on, so that children would not inherit all of the advantages or the disadvantages that their parents have to pass on to them. I will give them their family land back. I cancel the debts of the family so that children do not inherit those disadvantages. And unfortunately, or fortunately, if you are the creditor, you have to forgive all of that. You set people free, because God wants to give people their portion of the garden land in Israel, because he gave Adam and Eve their portion of the garden land. They were intended to pass it down to all of their children, and for Israel to live in a garden land as a window, as a picture of what it meant, what the garden originally meant. God says, no, I give every child a fresh start. You see, in our day, we don't do that. We allow children to be born into families with tremendous disadvantages and advantages. I'm not so sure about that. And then we have these additional stigmas today of, well, they're just poor families. But those children born into great wealth and those children born into great poverty, what did they do to deserve any of that? Nothing. Nothing. And so it is that Jesus is reworking his disciples to understand, no, include those people into your heart, into your life, at your table, at your meal. They are your friends. As you bear witness to what God's heart is, he wants to expand your sense of family. He wants to invite everyone to the table and say, come, eat with me here. Now, who are the outcasts today? How do we think about this? Well, are they the homeless people? Well, perhaps. Because especially if they smell like urine, there is a tendency for us to say, no way. Perhaps the mentally ill or those with mental health issues. Perhaps they're the poor cousins. You know how every family tends to have like the poor cousin, the person who's held up in the family as, don't be like cousin Harry. And you know, like you just kind of shaft that person at dinners when on Christmas and things like that. Well, that's the kind of person that Jesus wants to reach out to and include and restore into relationship. And so how does that look today? Well, let me tell you a little bit more about how my wife and I have wrestled with that and struggled to apply it and to see Jesus in our lives. In the year 2000, my wife and I bought this house in Dorchester in the second highest crime area in Boston. It's called the Franklin Park, Franklin Field area, and it's also called the Youth Corridor of Boston because the highest concentration of youth and the highest concentration of DCF, Department of Children and Families, case families live there. So reported cases of abuse, neglect, and so on. So we chose to buy a house there because we had some friends at a largely African-American church who were also around that area who were very interested in partnering together with us to live there and to be a blessing to the community. So we bought this three-decker house. It was an 11-bedroom, 4-bathroom, 3-kitchen house. And we lived sometimes like a big household together, a big family, because all of the people there were Christians who wanted to bless the neighborhood and wanted to learn what is the black church doing in order to deal with these really tough urban issues? And what can we learn from that? So, we bought this house. And the situation came up that one of our friends, her name is Tisha, she had an adopted brother. So her mom adopted a young boy who at the time had post-traumatic stress disorder because his birth mother was a drug abuser, and she had adopted him because the birth mother had lost custody of the young boy. So Tisha was noticing that, you know, that some of these problems were surfacing in school for her little brother, adopted brother. So she was a teacher, a Montessori school teacher. She asked our whole household, do you think it'd be possible for me to basically quit my job and homeschool my little adopted brother? Because this is really the time, if we catch it now, if we invest in him now, if we give him a lot of relational stability and love and pour into him academically, he might be able to just flourish. So we talked about that, and we talked about where we're at financially. And I wound up sharing that, well, look, I make about $40,000 a year as a campus minister before taxes. And this is our mortgage. We had bought the house for $245,000 in 2000, and our mortgage was about $2,000. So here's how this is all working out with each of you, and this is why we charge the amount. And if we were to do this, how can we do this together? See, and you're already feeling a little awkward, right? Because I'm a complete stranger, and I just shared with you how much I make. But isn't that what we do when we're family? We share our secrets, especially finances. Why is it in Christian community that we can talk about our family brokenness, our dysfunction, our sex lives perhaps, but we keep our money decisions to ourselves? Have we removed money from Christian accountability, even as Jesus calls us to serve the poor? And so we had this discussion, and everyone said, why don't we pay a little bit more in rent, every single person, so that it all evens out. Tisha can quit her job and homeschool her little brother. So she did that for 2 or 3 years. Then she actually found a job in the Midwest as a teacher. She was able to afford not one, but 2 houses out there where she started Christian communities and anchored them. She brought her family out there. Her little adopted brother went back into public school at some point, and now he's graduating this year with straight A's. We played a part as a community to care for someone vulnerable, a vulnerable child. And this is what we have come to understand about Jesus, is that He is expanding our sense of family. That's why there are two women who moved out of our house and bought houses up and down the street, two other houses, and they call them traction houses, and they are houses for 18 to 25-year-old young people who are trying to finish their GED or go to college or get their first job or just generally live independently and in a healthy way. They're residential discipleship programs, one for men and one for women, with someone there who's like an RA, a residence, kind of a mom or dad who's a Christian and discipling them in healthy living. And we're seeing just amazing things, challenging things, and some setbacks. But there are some great blessings to this. What happens when it is that we come together as a community for the sake of Jesus' mission to care for those that are pushed off and are the most vulnerable in our society? The poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. And what could that mean for you? Because for me, it has meant that I've come to understand just a little bit more the heart of God. Because I'm experiencing it. And it's awesome. I see it now in my son. My son is 13. He's in 7th grade. But before before 7th grade started, he was having some troubles making friends. Why is that? It's because, for a lot of reasons. There's the fact that he's the only Asian kid in his school. There's the fact that we're the only Asian family on our street. Maybe that had some, but also he's just a little quieter, you know, he's more calm, his parents are weird. So, what do you expect? So, my son John also looked at his younger sister Zoe. She had actually a good number of friends, both at school and in kind of the general area. And, you know, John had a friend who that family moved away to be for like missionaries to somewhere else. We're like, oh, we're really happy for you and for that country, but we're really sad for us. But God bless you guys. And so, you know, John has just struggled with having friends. But about 2 years ago, there was a young boy named Alain who is Haitian, and his older cousin brought him to this country after the Haiti earthquake, you know, because that family was in such turmoil. So cousin brought Alain to our neighborhood, and one of those days, Alain came into our church service and he was crying. So we stopped and we prayed and we asked what was going on. We heard his story. And as he was sharing, John felt a nudge in his heart. And afterward, he told my wife and me, you know, I feel like God is wanting me to be Ellen's friend. And I really want to. And I was so proud of him. Because this is a kid who has had difficulties making friends. And it wasn't like there was this instant connection with him and Ellen. Ellen's English is broken. It's sometimes difficult to understand him because of his Creole accent. He's undocumented and has just gone through difficulties trying to get services and stay in school. So it's not like there's this instant connection. But my son has picked up this part of the heart of Jesus because his sense of family is being stretched and growing and being enlarged. Because Jesus' heart is so big. What else can we do besides take small steps in and grow? And I really want us to be thinking again about who it is that comes to your mind. Who is in your heart right now? However old you are, whether you're thinking of a classmate, I don't know how old you guys are over here, or whether you're thinking of a neighbor, someone who seems alone, vulnerable, has been somewhat stigmatized. What would it mean to open your life in an appropriate way, with an appropriate level of trust, and say, let's sit at table together. Let's be friends. I want to share my life with you. And maybe that can be done with other people here in the congregation as well, or other Christians outside this room, as part of Jesus' mission, because we're all on this mission. And not only that, but it has to stretch beyond our home lives and our interpersonal, our most personal lives, to larger relationships. Because injustice fundamentally is based on an exclusion of people. And so how many of you have ever had or have domino sugar, like a bag of domino sugar, in your cupboard or in your drawer or on your table? Anyone? Y'all know actually why it's called domino sugar, why that company is called? It's because they're from the Dominican Republic. And there's actually this history of Catholic Dominicans there. So anyway, there's this name, domino sugar. Well, there was a group of college students who went down with Tony Campolo, who's a professor of sociology or was at Eastern College, and they were doing some kind of Christian missions project, helping out a community, and especially children, working with children in the Dominican Republic. And they noticed that this company, Domino Sugar, was doing a bunch of really bad things. They were not implementing crop rotation, which would deplete the soil. So Domino Sugar would have just depleted the soil and then moved on to somewhere else, and then, you know, what's left to grow food on? So they weren't doing that. They weren't paying very high wages to people. They were not reinvesting into infrastructure like education and roads and healthcare and all these things, even though they were there and they were really taking advantage of the cheap labor. So these Christian students researched more about this. They came back to the States. They wrote papers about it, and then they did this. They bought one share of Domino Sugar. That entitled them to go to a board meeting. They went and they said, "We are Christian students. We serve the community and the children in which your plant is. And we have noticed these things. You don't implement crop rotation, you're depleting the soil, you're leaving nothing left for these farming families and so on. And we also want you to know that we think Jesus will return one day and he will judge you for how you treated these people. And he cares about those people and how you run this company. And so, I don't know exactly what was going through the minds of those executives, but they said, give us a few weeks, we will talk about it. They reconvened and they said, we've researched this and we agree. So from here on out, we are going to pay higher wages. From here on out, we're going to rotate the soil and rotate crops so that we don't deplete the soil. If we ever have to leave, these families will have good soil. We will reinvest so many millions of dollars in health care and education for this community. And on and on. The issue was they had to be confronted with the reality that their decisions were impacting other people, but they defined shareholder interests very narrowly. Because companies are based on an exclusive sense of shareholder interest, of who really is affected by stuff we do. The Christian students wanted to say, no, you have to be inclusive. You have to include a whole bunch of other people in your decision making because you are actually affecting other people in ways that you're not recognizing. And we will buy our one share and make you, or at least remind you, of that fact. See, most injustices in this world is based on exclusion. It's the exclusion of people who are actually affected by decisions that you make. And Jesus' turning of that is to say, I want you to include people that you normally do not. The vulnerable, those you stigmatize or those you just blame. I want you to include them in your life and include them in the way that you make decisions. And at the end, Jesus says, you will be rewarded for this. I will reward you. He says in verse 14, you will be blessed. Since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. In other words, I think God knows your sacrifice. He knows your generosity. There is nothing He does not see, and there is nothing He does not notice. And so He gathers up all these things, and one day, He's saying, there will be a way in which all of your life and decisions made out of love and faithfulness to Him will somehow be remembered. And maybe it is that the investments that you make in other people will turn out for their good and will help them decide to come to Jesus. And they will be there, and your reward will be their presence. I think that's what it is for Jesus. That as He has given His life for the whole world, that there will be people who turn to Him, that He says, you're my treasure. You are my reward. It was worth it because of you and because I love you. And I want to attest that people will come to Jesus, because this world is looking for a community that is loving in a radical way, inclusive in a radical way. Because deep down, every single person is hungering for Jesus. They're hungering to see Him enfleshed by His Spirit into us. Even if they don't say it that way, that is what's going on. And so I want to encourage you, take some small step. That person that has come to your mind and heart, or the thing that you've been considering, or maybe this is even a way to reconsider how you live, where you live, what you do, how you do it. That's great. All of these things. Let's bring that before the Lord. And let's let Him guide us one step further. Let me close in prayer. Lord, thank You very much for each person here and for their patience with me as we have reflected together on this word of Yours. Lord, would You continue to make this beautiful image fill our mind? Give us increasing vision of how we can reflect Your desire to eat with people again, as You did in Eden, and as You desire to do because of the great banquet that's waiting for us at the turning of the ages. Thank You for the opportunity to manifest Your love and Your kingdom to those who are the most vulnerable, and especially the children who in and of themselves have done nothing to deserve one thing either way, because You love those little ones. And they're a picture to us of who You call us to be in many ways. And so I pray that You would help us to sit with these the thoughts, the considerations, and the concerns that we have, and help us to process what our next step is with You. That Your life would be known here, that Your love would be felt and expressed here, that this would be for Your glory and for our joy. That it would also be for the good of others. In Jesus' name, amen.